From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowane. House Speaker John Boehner told a Cincinnati radio station yesterday, "We fought the good fight, we just didn't win." He was referring to the battle over the debt ceiling and the partial shutdown of the federal government. Yesterday, the House and Senate voted to reopen the government and increase the borrowing authority of the government. Today on Radio Times, the political, economic, and financial costs of the fight over the federal budget and near default. Our guests are Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University. We'll also talk about the results of yesterday's Senate race in New Jersey, and Rana Fruhar. She's Time Magazine's assistant managing editor in charge of economics and business. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The federal government is opening for business. Congress passed a bill temporarily ending the partial shutdown and averting default. President Obama signed it, ending the 16-day budget battle. The law keeps the federal government open through January 15th and allows it to continue borrowing money through February 15th. The fiscal showdown is likely to have lingering effects on the economy, but NPR's Craig Windham reports some economists fear continued political uncertainty will dampen already slow economic growth in the months ahead.
Mark Zandi, chief economist with Moody's Analytics, estimates that the shutdown and the battle over the debt ceiling probably cost the U.S. economy more than $20 billion. And Zandi says the political brinksmanship that plagues Washington is an ongoing drag on the economy. He says it's crucial now to establish a stronger rate of growth.
And the key to doing that is getting Washington off the front pages.
Zandi is urging Congress to do nothing that could affect the economy for the next 3 or 4 years.
Literally, all Washington has to do is go away, and we're going to be just fine.
Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
The White House budget director instructed all furloughed federal workers to return to their jobs starting today. They were out for more than 2 weeks. Congress and the president agreed on a bill giving furloughed workers back pay. But NPR's Allison Key says there are a lot of people hurt by the shutdown who won't get any money.
Some of the contractors I've spoken to this morning do not think they're going to get back pay. And the hot dog stand gentleman who lost 70% of his salary, like the other restaurants in the area, of course, aren't going to get back pay. So they still have to pay their workers. They still have to pay their rent. And they're very concerned about how this went down.
NPR's Allison Keyes in Washington, D.C. There's still no strike or deal for Northern California's Bay Area Rapid Transit System called BART. From member station KALW, Isabel Angel reports the unions agreed again to keep talks going without interrupting service.
Wednesday, for the third night in a row, federal mediator George Cohen said that BART and its unions were still at the table, that progress was being made, and that the trains would continue to run for one more day. BART officials blamed the late-night announcements for a reported drop in riders this week. California Governor Jerry Brown halted a possible bus strike by union workers from Bay Area's AC Transit on Wednesday. AC Transit carries about 100,000 riders a day. BART carries twice that. For NPR News, I'm Isabel Angel in San Francisco.
The Senate has confirmed Caroline Kennedy to be the next U.S. ambassador to Japan. The vote was unanimous. Kennedy is the daughter of the late President John F. Kennedy. Her nomination was approved last month in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but it was held up by the government shutdown. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 108 points. It's at 15,265. This is NPR.
NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the David Geffen Foundation, promoting the arts, culture, and civic engagement.
It's 10:04, temperature 64 in Philadelphia. It'll be mild today, the high about 74, and then some cooler weather moves in for tomorrow. Good morning. I'm Mary Cummings, Jordan, WHYY News. Cory Booker will serve as U.S. Senator from New Jersey, filling the term of the late Frank Lautenberg. He beat former Bogota Mayor Steve Lonegan handily with 55% of the vote in a special election on Wednesday. Booker says he'll represent all the people of New Jersey equally and be a voice for the voiceless.
I owe it to every leader, every religious leader, every community leader, every block leader, every social media leader, Twitter leader, whoever you were. You all spoke about this campaign and the pressing issues that made this election so important to New Jersey and all of America.
Steve Lonergan, meanwhile, says he has no plans to run again and that he'll return to the business sector. Residents of New Jersey brought to the U.S. illegally as children might soon be able to pay the in-state tuition rate at Rutgers and other universities. Governor Christie says he's considering approving legislation allowing the lower rates. Here's WHYY's Emma Jacobs.
Christie has said in the past that only lawfully present taxpayers deserve the tuition break. During his last debate with Democratic gubernatorial candidate Barbara Buono, Christie said he has been waiting for the economy to improve before putting another burden on New Jersey's colleges and universities. Gordon McInnes of the liberal think tank New Jersey Policy Perspective calls the governor's remarks encouraging.
It follows on a statement that he made over the weekend where he has shown his strong support for tuition equity. And that is essential for motivating the legislature and the governor to enact tuition equity.
McInnes expects the change would not cost New Jersey educational institutions very much. Of 50,000 students at Rutgers, he says only about 150 currently pay out-of-state tuition rates because they don't have Social Security numbers. Usually, only students in the country illegally lack these numbers. Emma Jacobs, WHYY News.
In sports, Flyers, Penguins at the center tonight. Puck drops at 7, and the Sixers meet the Bobcats in preseason play at 11 this morning. 66 degrees in Philadelphia. It's WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. After 16 days at a cost of an estimated $20 billion to the U.S. economy, the Senate and House agreed yesterday to end the partial government shutdown and fund federal agencies until mid-January. It also extended the government's borrowing authority until February 7th. The sequester remains in effect. President Obama signed the deal late last night. The Republicans, led by Senator Cruz, wanted to tie the budget and borrowing to defunding the Affordable Care Act and came up largely empty-handed. In fact, the battle revealed deep fissures and animosities within the GOP and a shockingly low approval rating among the public. Will the country go through this all over again in 2014? What are the financial costs for this kind of political brinksmanship? Is this any way to run a country? We have two guests who have joined us. Ross Baker is a political science professor at Rutgers University. And Ross, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us, Rana Faruhar, Time Magazine's assistant managing editor in charge of economics and business, joining us from the studios of Time. And Rana, nice to have you back with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Ross, if I could begin with you and begin with the fact that last night there was this deal. It ended up being a bipartisan deal in many ways. How necessary was this crisis?
Well, I think that it was something that was bound to happen. I think that you've got a group of Republican members who felt committed to the dismantlement of the Affordable Care Act. They were getting this message from their constituents. They were elected in 2010, largely on the strength of their opposition to the Affordable Care Act. And they, in a sense, were being true to their constituents. There are a large number of them, 144 who voted against the final settlement. I think within that group you would find probably the 40 or 50 hardcore Tea Party people elected in 2010. So I think that, you know, given the mandate that they saw that they had, given the fact that they also played upon the fears of moderate Republicans that they might be challenged in primary elections, I think in a sense it was inevitable.
Well, I want to pick up on that, but Rana, let me turn to you. And the number that I came across was that the cost to the U.S. economy, something in the $20 billion range. Does that square with your assessment?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and what's interesting is if you go back farther and look at the last 3 years of political gridlock, because let's remember this isn't an isolated incident. We have been at this point many, many times. Back in August of 2011, we had the same issues. The Dow dropped 13% during the debt wranglings then. There's an interesting study that was actually put out by the Peterson Foundation recently that found that over the last 3 years, the gridlock, the battles, the constant fighting, the dysfunction in Congress, Congress has shaved an entire percentage point of GDP growth off of our $16 trillion economy and cost us 2 million jobs. Mm. 2 million jobs. I mean, this is shameful, frankly, and we have got to find a way out of it. And kicking the can into next year is not a solution.
Well, you have said, and I've heard others say as well, is that the Congress is bad for the U.S. economy.
If
you
do,
if you do this
absolutely.
Sort of you know, financial analysis, it certainly looks like it.
Well, you know, it was interesting. I heard on the NPR program earlier, Mark Zandi saying if government would just get out of the way, we'd be fine. That's completely true. If you look at the GDP numbers, if you look at the growth figures, and you strip out the public sector, we would have already have been in a 3% growth environment. 3-4% growth is historically what the U.S. should be having based on our innovation, our businesses, our demographics. But we are in a 2% economy, and frankly, we'll be struggling to stay in a 2% economy this year because of the shutdown.
Ross, let me go back to you because there is the question that if John Boehner had allowed the vote last night to go through 3 weeks ago, there's probably a good chance that it would have passed and this could have all been avoided.
Well, that's true. There were a number of things that were operating against the quick vote on the continuing resolution on federal spending. One was, I think, John Boehner's own concern about his job as Speaker. I know that many people think that this wasn't about Boehner's speakership, but I think to a very great extent it was. And I think that was one of the things that inhibited an early vote. The other was, as I said before, I think a fear and concern on the part of moderate Republicans that they would be primaried. And that, in fact, they had to defer to the more radical members of the Republican conference, and let them play out their string. And it's interesting to note that Republicans stood in the ranks and voted consistently mm-hmm. to defund Obamacare. They generally supported the leadership. And so I think that it was one of these things that's had to run its course. It was like sort of a bad fever that you have. And, you know, you can take all kinds of antibiotics and other things, but it basically has to run its course.
But it's a fever that has hurt. I mean, it seems like, based on what you've been saying, Ron, a fever that has hurt this country.
Well, it's a fever that's also going to spike again in February. It's like one of those terrible bugs that you get in the hospital and the antibiotics aren't working, you know? I mean, it's a great metaphor, but unfortunately, the markets are prepared for this to happen again and again and again. And, you know, here's an interesting little fact that I noticed this morning. A lot of people throughout this entire debt debacle have been saying, well, what's this going to do to the U.S. dollar? Are people going to sell off Treasury bills because they're worried about the trust and faith in the U.S. government? That hasn't happened yet. It didn't really happen so much throughout the crisis. But this morning, gold was up. Gold spiked. Now, gold is a safety haven. Gold is something that people turn to when they are worried about what's going to happen next. I think it's fascinating that after this deal, which just kicked the can down to February, we're going to be in the same spot. I'll be back on your show sometime in February
sure
talking about the same things. And, you know, the markets are saying we're worried. People are buying gold. I think that's very interesting.
Well, let me pick up on that. And Ross, go back to you. I mean, do you think the Republicans, especially the Republicans that wanted to defund Obamacare and tie that to the budget and to the borrowing, are they in any way chastened? Do they feel like they have lost something? Do they feel like they're the winners?
Well, you know, I agree with Ron. And I'm sort of reminded of something that Winston Churchill said after the evacuation of the British troops from Dunkirk in 1940. He said, we must be very careful not to assign to this deliverance the attributes of a victory. And I think that that's correct. I think it was a deliverance, and I don't see it as a victory. And I do see, for example, the looming deadlines of the for example, the Budget Conference Committee, which is one of the things that was set up as a result of this deal. This is something that in the normal order of things in Congress should have been done. Mm. This is a regular conference committee between the House and the Senate. But, you know, the history of these things has now become really pretty problematic. I'm sure you remember something called the Super Committee.
Indeed.
Which was set up as part of the Budget Control Act in 2011. And, of course, it failed to produce the budget cuts or revenue sources that it was charged to produce. And we've got this debt ceiling being reached again on February the 7th. And, you know, I just see this as being, you know, just an opportunity to refight the old battle.
Well, Rana, let me pick up on that. And that super committee had this sequester gun at their head, basically saying, you know, who would vote for a sequester? And was supposed to force them to come to some kind of compromise. Mm-hmm. They couldn't do that. The sequester's in effect. How has this sequester been hurting the U.S. economy? And who has it been hurting?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, I just want to say nothing ever got done in a super committee. You know, so the idea that anything ever was going to get done in a super committee was ridiculous. But, you know, thinking about the sequester, there's two points that I would make. The sequester was supposed to be all along the worst possible outcome, right? That's why we set it up that way, because the idea was that everybody would want to avoid this at all costs, because what it did was not address our real debt and deficit issues, which are long-term entitlement problems and long-term rises in the cost of healthcare. But it cut everything that fuels short-term growth. It cut programs for the neediest. It cut research and development. It cut departments that are responsible for funding the kind of growth that we need in this country right now. So that's point number one. But point number two, and this is the great irony of a debt and deficit fight, is that it actually put us in a better short-term picture deficit-wise. So while Republicans are wrangling about the deficit's actually been falling. We've been in a better fiscal position over the last year because of this.
Well, do you think, Ross, that it'll be deja vu all over again when 2014 begins?
I really do. I mean, I think we made certain assumptions about the Republicans. And let me refer back to the sequester question. I think there was a belief that Republicans, because traditionally they've been the very, very strong supporters of the Pentagon and the Pentagon budget and so on, that they would find the across-the-board cuts that affected the Defense Department so odious that they would not support the sequester. Well, it turns out that, yeah, there are such Republicans, but they are now in a minority. I think that, for example, I think the business community and Wall Street in particular made certain assumptions about Republicans, which turned out also to be untrue, or at least only partially true. I think that the Republicans who drove this entire shutdown mechanism are a different kind of Republican that doesn't respond to the entreaties of Wall Street and does not necessarily uncritically support the Pentagon.
I want to jump in on that because
Please
I think
do,
that
Rana.
That's a very, very important point. I think that business is shocked because business has traditionally been the party, or the Republican Party has been the party of business. But I think that you're seeing a shift. I think that, you know, when I talk to business leaders, they want investment. They want Congress to get over their dysfunction. They want reform of education. You know, they want a lot of things that are actually part of a left-leaning agenda. So I think that's a very interesting political shift that's happening.
Well, and just picking up on that, Rana, what's interesting, if the people that wanted to shut the government down are affiliated with the Tea Party. The Tea Party hated TARP. They hated the bank bailout.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And I think that there's two issues. You know, there's kind of corporate America and big business and what the growth agenda is. But there's also Wall Street. And you're right. The Tea Party hated Wall Street. And frankly, a lot of liberals hated the bailouts as well. I think that there is, unfortunately, a perception. And I think the administration is the Obama administration has forwarded this in some ways, that there's been a preferential treatment of Wall Street versus Main Street. And that's come back to haunt us.
We're almost up on a break, Ross, but I'm wondering, do you see John Boehner as weakened by what happened, as strengthened, as kind of a wash for him?
Well, based on what some of the hardliners said after the deal was sealed, they seem to support him. They seem to believe he couldn't have done things better, that he sort of let them do what they needed to do, and then finally at the end got a deal. So I think that John Boehner is secure, and I think in that sense his strategy was very astute if the saving of his job was his primary objective.
And secure to fight another day in 2014?
Absolutely.
That's Ross Baker, political science professor at Rutgers University. Also with us, Rana Farooqar, and she's Times Assistant Managing Editor in charge of economics and business. Both of them joining us in this hour as we talk about the decision late last night to end, to send, frankly, government workers back to work today. They're back on the job, and also to deal with this debt ceiling issue, at least temporarily. We want to hear from you. What do you think about your government? 1-888-477-9222. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. The new healthcare law is here, and Independence Blue Cross can help consumers understand how the new law affects individuals and families. Independence Blue Cross has been here for 75 years, and they're committed to being here for whatever lies ahead. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. To find out more about how the healthcare law could affect you, details at ibx.com.
I'm Marty Moss Cohen. It's day two of the fall membership campaign at WHYY and day one of the end of the partial government shutdown, an issue we have been covering on Radio Times. That's why you listen, to stay informed, to be in the know. We also introduce you to interesting people and ideas like our guest today, novelist Nicholson Baker. Make a pledge right now at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. You'll be glad you did. I promise.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Music, said Claude Debussy, must be as boundless as the wind, the sky, the sea. The Philadelphia Orchestra and Raphael Frubeck de Burgos perform Debussy's La Mer, plus Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorc.org. October 24th, 25th, and 26th at the Kimmel Center. La Mer and more with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're talking about the political, economic, and financial costs of the fight over the federal budget and near default. Again, our guests are Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University, and Rana Faruhar, Times assistant managing editor in charge of economics and business. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Ron, I will confess that until a couple of months ago, I probably didn't really understand what defaulting on the debt really meant. But I have to say, I was kind of shocked when I heard members of Congress basically saying this was no big deal. What does that tell us about how some people get elected to the U.S. Congress?
Oh, where to begin? I mean, for starters, it's a huge deal. The fact that any politician would publicly say that it wasn't it's so worrisome, you know, and it really is reflected in the fact that the ratings agencies, Fitch, Moody's, S&P, when they talk about downgrading the U.S., they're not talking about economic figures. I mean, you know, compared to Europe in particular, we're actually in pretty good shape. You know, as I mentioned earlier, our deficit has actually been falling because of all the cuts that have come into effect in the last couple of years. It's our politics that's problematic. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that Congress would say things like this and that would publicly, you know, take us to the brink time and time and time again. Just to talk a little bit about what a default really would mean. So people use the word in different ways. You know, people talk about, well, you're defaulting if you go over the debt ceiling. Well, that's not exactly the case. A technical default means not paying your bills. It means not paying your creditors. China, for example, which owns 47% of our treasury bills, not paying them on time. Now, I'll be honest and say that most economists never really thought that that was at risk, in part because the way in which those payments are made is kind of separated out from the millions and millions of other daily payments that the government has to make. So we probably could have come up with ways to put revenue on those debt payments and not default. Now, if we actually didn't pay back our creditors, that would absolutely be a catastrophic market event. It would be a Lehman Brothers-type catastrophe, and there's just no way we can go there.
What's interesting also, Ross, is to hear the frustration from Senators John McCain, Senator Lindsey Graham, other Republicans in Congress who seemed very frustrated and put off by some of what was happening within their party.
Yes, I think being used is a good word. And I think that one of the things that caused their consternation was the fact that this whole thing was being driven by the most junior members of Congress. I mean, in what other human organization do the most junior people drive the entire process? After all, I mean, the class of 2010, you know, has basically been there at most for 3 years. Ted Cruz, freshman senator, being the person who's the who's the field marshal of this ill-starred campaign, is really quite extraordinary. So I think that people like McCain and Lindsey Graham, and a whole bunch of the senators, the Republican senators, who voted to support the final deal, I think were quite baffled by it. And some of them, to the point where they were willing to go on the record. People like Richard Burr of North Carolina, who always also stands the possibility of a challenge from the right, was consistently critical of them. So, what you had then was sort of a revolt of the backbenchers, but the backbenchers really did, with a minimum of information about the process, which is interesting. Harry Reid understood how this was going to end. They didn't. They believed simply that enthusiasm would carry them along, and ultimately that they would be able to defund Obamacare, which was their core objective. And it turned out they just didn't understand the legislative process, which I think any good civic student would have understood.
Well, I actually thought it was pretty revealing last night. The junior senator from Texas, Ted Cruz, went to talk to the press at the exact time that Senator Mitch McConnell was talking in the Senate. And Ross, it's hard to believe that that was just an accident.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I think that Cruz saw this as an opportunity to foster his larger ambitions. He's an enormously eloquent man, but very, very much a novice as far as the Senate is concerned, as was demonstrated by the so-called filibuster, which did not do what filibusters ordinarily are designed to do, which is really slow down the process. And he basically gave a speech on the floor. That was really the effect of it. And it's quite interesting, of course, that in this situation, here was a senator basically leading a kind of children's crusade of junior House members against Obamacare and really buying into a lot of myths about default. I mean, I think that Representative Ted Yolo from Florida is probably the best example of that, who said, well, no, actually the default would be a tonic for markets, which is absurd.
Well, Ronnie, you want to jump in on that? Then we'll get to our callers. Go ahead.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, the idea that a default could be a tonic for markets is just – it's so crazy-making. Just to give you an example of what happens when a country defaults, I'll go to two historic examples. We actually did have a very, very tiny technical default on Treasury bills in this country back in 1979. That was due to, if you can believe it, a software glitch that delayed payments for a couple of days. Now, there was never any doubt that people were going to get their money. But that tiny event pushed interest rates up over a half a percentage point, and they stayed up for several months. It resulted in an additional $12 billion of interest payments on Treasury bills. That was picked up by taxpayers. That's an example of what happens when you default. And that wasn't even anything like the sort of purposeful, politically oriented default that we were talking about. If you look at other countries, I mean, you know, going to the edge again and again and again and playing chicken with your national debt is what emerging markets do. And look at Argentina, for example. That's an emerging market country that had an actual default 12 years ago. They are still paying double-digit interest rates. Now, I'm not saying that the U.S. is Argentina, but just think about what those sorts of rate hikes do. It would make it impossible for a lot of people to afford their homes. I certainly couldn't pay for the house I live in Brooklyn, New York, if interest rates were a lot higher than they are now. People's cars, their student debt, that affects the way that we live and our quality of life.
And that's Rana Farooqar, Times Assistant Managing Editor in charge of economics and business. Also with us, Ross Baker, political science professor at Rutgers University, talking about the last couple of weeks of politics. Last night, the U.S. Congress voted to end the partial government shutdown and to allow the government to pay its bills, signed by President Obama shortly before midnight. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499 and reading emails, radiotimes@whyy.org. Let me get Gary from Malvern, Pennsylvania, to join us. And Gary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I'm so angry, it's hard for me to even speak right now as far as that this has happened. I mean, I'll make it clear. I'm so glad that Cool Minds ruled. I was a Republican some years ago. I became more or less a political independent. But I am seeing things that so concern me that I'm going to recommend to all my friends, we need to save the Republican Party from a power grab that is endangering our country. I can tell you for a fact, in my own legislative district where I live at the state level, that the Tea Party is already threatening to put up a candidate against my assemblyman because he's too moderate. I think it's time for moderate Republicans to stand up and save this party and save this country. And I'm going to re-register as a Republican. And I'm going to try to, I mean, the Republican Party has to change. That's why I left it. It was turning into something I didn't agree with. But what is happening now is so frightening. I am so frustrated. Suffering. These are the guys that said we're only about jobs. They have thrown jobs out the window.
Well, Gary, let me take your point, and we hear your frustration and your anger, and you raise an interesting point. And, Russ, let me toss this back to you, because looking at some of the polling, and it's pretty consistent, a lot of frustration within the Republican Party about the party. Gary says, I'm going to rejoin it, and I'm going to refashion this party to represent my ideas.
Well, you know, Gary brings up a point that I've been thinking a lot about. And that is, there is a congressional election in 2014. And my theory is that some of the more moderate Republicans, the people who basically were counseling moderation throughout this crisis, are really going to be targeted by the Democrats. They're not going to target the Tea Party people because they basically represent congressional districts that are bastions of Republicanism. They win with 70-80% of the two-party vote. It's people like Charlie Dent in Pennsylvania, or Lou Barletta, people like that, who I think will not only be targeted by the Democrats, but also I think face the prospect of being attacked from the right by a Republican primary. Jim Gerlach, also another Pennsylvania member who voted ultimately for the settlement. So I think that this was in the minds of a lot of people when they when they were going through this. I think that a lot of the support that the Tea Party people had all along was basically on the part of fearful Republicans who are concerned about these primary challenges.
Gary mentioned jobs, Rana, and we touched on this briefly, but yes, the economy, the job situation is better, but not when you count a lot of people that have essentially given up on jobs. And even when you look deeper into the jobs, you see that many of them are low or moderate wage jobs. Mm. Are we in the kind of recovery that can sustain the kind of country that we are?
In a word, no. And I think that that's a very interesting point. I'm actually very heartened by what Gary has to say, because I tend to lean more liberal myself. But we need the best ideas from both sides of the aisle right now, because we are really, I believe, in a kind of multi-decade turning point in our economy. So if you look at what's been happening over the last 5 years since the financial crisis, the Great Recession and the recovery, we are in the slowest, weakest recovery of the post-World War II period. It's going to take us over 30 more months to get back to our pre-crisis levels of employment, and that's after 5 years. So this is, a lot of people think, a real structural change. If you look at the fastest growing jobs in the country, 8 out of 10 of the fastest growing job categories are minimum wage jobs. They're low-level $15 an hour positions in services, in tourism. We have jobs at the very, very high end. We have a lot of PhDs. We have Silicon Valley companies creating high-end jobs, and we have a lot of low-end jobs, but we've lost the middle. And we need real structural shifts to get that back. We need investment in infrastructure. We need a revamp and a rethinking of education. And we need the best liberal and conservative ideas to do that. That's why it's so important for Congress to begin working together, because we really can't do it without a functional government.
Well, in fact, Rana, you said that in one of your stories that 63% of the population is working.
Yes.
And you're saying that's almost EU numbers.
That's right. I mean, this is actually – it's an interesting point because we talk a lot about the unemployment level, which is 7.3% right now, although I think that's probably going to go tick back up after the last few weeks of shutdown. But the number we should really be looking at is the workforce participation rate, because that tells us how many people are really employed, fully employed in our economy. And that is at its lowest level since the 1980s, which is when women began entering the workforce en masse. So we are really working at European levels right now. You know, we like to think of ourselves as such a hardworking country, so entrepreneurial. But all of the headwinds, the congressional headwinds, the headwinds about people needing to get funding for businesses, it's dampening growth in our economy. And this is something that I know, for example, the Fed is very concerned about. I think that you're going to see Janet Yellen, the new Fed chief, who's coming in thinking a lot about that workforce participation rate and how to get that back up.
Gary, thanks for the call. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Russ, let me segue to Cory Booker's win last night. He's going to be representing New Jersey in the U.S. Senate, and he talked a lot, and the campaigning that he did talked a lot about working together, finding common ground. Do you see him making an impact? It's only 15 months until it's still the next election for U.S. Senate, but do you see him making a difference in the U.S. Congress?
Well, I think that the standard pledge on the part of newly elected members of Congress that they're going to Washington and change things, and of course, they run headlong into the realities. I think it's very nice that he is, you know, decided that he's going to play a constructive role and that he's going to talk across party lines and so on. But I think I have to say something about the election.
Yeah, please.
It was much narrower a victory than it should have been. That structurally, New Jersey really is a Democratic state at the congressional level. We have not elected a Republican senator since 1978. We elect Republican governors from time to time, as we have one now. I think that Senator-elect Booker, I think, really looked upon this election more as a coronation. He believed that his superior name recognition, after all, how many people knew who the mayor of Bogota, New Jersey was? And Bogota is a very small place. Yet he, of course, was somebody with a national reputation, and I think he believed he was going to coast to victory. That special elections are unpredictable, and what usually happens in special elections is that the only people who are really interested in them are people in the base of the political parties. And it turns out that the election results, I think we're going to see an unusually large turnout of people from the very conservative Republican base coming out to vote for Steve Lonergan. So I think there's a cautionary tale here for Senator-elect Booker, and that is that he can't assume that his superior name recognition is his glittering smile and his witty manner is going to carry him through even after 15 months of incumbency.
Well, Steve Lonergan, very willing to throw punches, which he did. It was interesting to see Sarah Palin in New Jersey, Rick Perry in New Jersey. It's a blue state, Ross, and it's unusual to see those people coming in and stumping for a candidate.
Well, it is. I mean, it didn't cost them very much. I mean, clearly Rick Perry is interested in 2016 and Sarah Palin is just interested in exposure. So it was something that might have been expected. But, he ran a very aggressive campaign. He's a smart guy and not afraid to throw his elbows. And as a consequence, I think that Booker was kind of thrown off balance. I hope that Senator Booker goes to Washington with the intention of being the best senator from New Jersey. The last thing the Democrats need is a Democratic Ted Cruz.
Mm. Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Ross Baker, political science professor at Rutgers University. Also with us, Rana Faruhar, Times assistant managing editor in charge of economics and business. We've been spending the hour talking about the threatened default on the debt and the fact that there were for almost 2 weeks, about a week and a half, members of the federal government that were not going to work. They were furloughed or some working without pay. Talking about some of the political, economic, and financial fallout from all of that. Taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Emails, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, The Economist, covering news and ideas that interconnect the world to give readers a worldview. On newsstands, in bookstores, at economist.com, or on smartphones and tablets.
Penn supports WHYY. Do you frequently walk into a room and immediately forget why? Do you need to write things down to remember them? If this sounds familiar to you, you may qualify for a research study focusing on cognition and memory in menopausal women. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness is seeking women between the ages of 45 and 60 to participate in research to study the effects of certain hormones and medication on cognition in peri- and postmenopausal women. 215-41-STUDY.
I'm Marty Moscowain. I want you to be a member of the WHYY family by making a pledge of support right now. Here's that phone number, 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. Where else do you hear in-depth interviews with a diverse group of people on wide-ranging topics 2 hours a day, 5 days a week? That's where your money goes to support this kind of radio. 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks.
Pico supports WHYY. Inefficient lighting can account for 30 to 60% of your business's annual electricity costs. The Pico Smart Business e-audit offers customized tips to help manage energy costs. Details at pico.com/smartideas.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. House Speaker John Boehner told a Cincinnati radio station yesterday, "We fought the good fight, we just didn't win." He was referring to the battle over the debt ceiling and the partial shutdown of the federal government. Yesterday, as we all know, the House and Senate voted to reopen the government and increase the borrowing authority of the government until early next year. We're talking about all of this with Rana Faruhar and Ross Baker. We had a email from Lucinda from Reddington, New Jersey. And this is to you, Rana. Is Simpson Bowles a possible solution to this current situation? I know we could probably do a whole hour on that. Is there a short answer to that question?
Yes.
Was yes. the answer yes?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it would have been. Simpson Bowles was a great idea. You know, it was bipartisan. It was sensible. It got, I think, as well as any piece of legislation I've seen, to the heart of our debt problems, which are really about curbing long-term entitlement issues, not cutting off, you know, cutting ourselves off at the knees in terms of the short-term government spending that really fuels our growth. I mean, you know, unfortunately, this has gone by the wayside, and I don't hear a conversation starting back up, although, you know, we can hope that it might. But it's crucial, because what we really need to understand in this country, and I get so frustrated when I hear the deficit and debt debates, because they talk about short-term issues when really we don't have short-term serious debt issues in this country. I mean, look at Europe. Our debt to GDP ratio is far below the European countries. They have real debt problems. What we have is a long-term healthcare spending problem and entitlement reform that we need to make. But, of course, those are incredibly hot political issues, and nobody wants to take them on.
And part of Bowles-Simpson, though, did include tax increases, did it not, Rana?
Yes, yes. And I think that's actually another great point. We need, you know, there's a 4% gap right now between what we spend in this country and what we take in tax revenue. And you've got to close that gap somehow. And in order to close it, you need both sensible long-term entitlement and healthcare reforms, but you also need to raise some new revenue. And I think that there are lots of areas that you could do that that would be fair, that would not cause pain to the middle class and to the working class. I mean, the very first thing I would look at would be capital gains taxes and the way those are done. I mean, we have a system in this country where people who make money by having a lot of money sitting around pay the lowest level of taxes, and I just think most people would agree that that's unfair.
You want to weigh in on that, Ross, and we'll get back to our callers. Go ahead.
I sure do. Yeah. No, I agree with Ron. I think that entitlement reform is very important. The problem is it's the Democrats' family jewels. And one of the things about Simpson-Bowles was it was very clear at the time that it would never be accepted by Democrats because it called for entitlement cuts. I mean, even something as simple as what's called the chain CPI, which is a recalculation of the consumer product index in terms of Social Security cost of living adjustments, is a flashpoint for Democrats. The Democrats see themselves as the guardians and protectors of the New Deal and the Fair Deal. When Senator Mark Warner from Virginia led this so-called Gang of Six, one of many Senate gangs that has emerged in recent years, one of the things basically their plan was the legislative language for Simpson-Bowles. Took it to the majority leader Reid, and he said, "Forget about it. You know that the Democratic base would reject this." So this is a problem the Democrats have in terms of entitlement reform, which I think is quite important and necessary to do.
Let me get Terry Gillen from Philadelphia Mayor Nutter's office. And Terry, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
thanks.
There. You're welcome. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask your experts where they think we'll be able to go next year, and whether they think there's any possibility for structural reform, because we're obviously going to be back at this in a couple of months. And there are a lot of people who think that we have some really structural problems, like the need for filibuster reform, which is something the Common Cause has been pushing. The need for redistricting reform, that because of gerrymandering, we have really extreme districts. The need for campaign finance reform. So do your experts think that there's any chance we'll get any kind of structural reform out of this mess?
What do you think, Rana? Thanks, Darren.
I'm very pessimistic about structural reform out of Washington right now, unfortunately. I think that, one of the many problems about kicking the debt ceiling debate down the road is that, this is what the issue is going to be. We're not going to have any bigger, more important discussions other than this, and certainly until February. One little light at the tunnel, though, is the fact that, when I travel around the country doing stories, looking at how local economies are coping with this slow recovery, I see a lot of hope at the local level. I see communities basically looking in Washington and saying, we cannot bet our economic future on what's happening in Washington. We cannot expect the federal government and Congress to come up with ideas to save us. So we're going to save ourselves. And what I think is happening is that you have a lot of very interesting experiments bubbling up at the local level, public-private partnerships in happening in interesting ways. I'm actually going to be tomorrow at the Chicago Ideas Festival talking about a concept called localnomics, which I believe is really kind of the future and our best hope for growth, where local cities, regions come together and come up with political compromise and interesting ideas around education, infrastructure. And I think that some of those ideas will catch fire and hopefully at a national level become more the norm.
What are your thoughts, Ross, about the possibility of structural change?
Well, as far as Congress is concerned, I think the chances are slim to none. I think the best that was able to be achieved was basically a personal agreement between Senator Reid and Senator McConnell about filibustering just one particular point in the whole filibuster process. And, in the Senate, of course, there are six different points at which a bill can be filibustered, and they just basically had an agreement on one. So, and at that, I think they considered a great achievement. As far as redistricting is concerned, I think that that's something that certainly what we got in 2010 was a year in which the Republicans triumphed at the state levels as well as in Congress. And these Republican state legislatures were able to set up very comfortable districts for their members, and so obviously there's a vested interest in the system as it is, and I think it'd be very difficult to crack that. And in fact, it's really talk about kind of local responses to what's happening in Washington. On the other side of what Rana was talking about is the, believe it or not, the resurrection of the doctrine of nullification and interposition.
I don't know what that is. What is that?
Which we thought had been put to rest by the victory of the North in the Civil War.
Okay, we're going back that far. Oh dear.
Right. Yeah. I mean, what you have, you know, in Missouri, for example, if Governor Jay Nixon had not vetoed it, the state legislature had passed a state law saying that federal officials could not operate in Missouri to enforce federal gun laws, which would have presented the odd spectacle of the Missouri State Police arresting FBI officers. But you've got secession movements in Northern California, in Northeastern Colorado, even in Maryland, for goodness sake, a blue state.
Let me ask you, you mentioned the names Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell came up. And Ross, let me go back to you only because of your knowledge about how Congress works, because I think the theater of negotiations is so interesting and in certain ways so theatrical, because this week they were talking about my good friend Harry Reid, my good friend Mitch McConnell, and yet it seemed like just a couple of days earlier they were at each other's throats. What does that tell us?
It was the triumph of the two most taciturn men in American politics.
Very, yeah. Is that what it sounds like?
Right. I sort of need to reveal my association here, and that is that I spent two of my sabbatical leaves in Harry Reid's office and had an opportunity to observe him at close hand. And when Reid and McConnell got together in the room, Harry Reid was the chatterbox.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Mitch McConnell's even more buttoned up than Harry Reid. But you know, the thing is, they have so much in common. Obviously, they're both floor leaders of their parties. They're both former members of the Appropriations Committee, and appropriators have a completely different outlook on life than other members of Congress. They don't campaign against each other. Reid will not go to Kentucky to campaign against Mitch McConnell. McConnell did not go to Nevada to campaign against Reid. It's a strange kind of odd couple relationship, but obviously it's one which, you know, under the right circumstances works. And by the way, this whole crisis really does illuminate the difference between the House and the Senate.
Indeed. Mm. Let me get that. Looks like Jeffrey from Kennett Square to join our conversation. And Jeffrey, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'd like to have your guest comment, please, on Grover Norquist's demand that Republicans, politicians, not increase taxes. If we take $16 trillion debt divided by 300 million Americans, that's over $50,000 per person, man, woman, and child. How do the Republicans expect to repay that? Is it feasible?
Jeffrey, let me see what Rana Faruhar has to say. Rana, your thoughts.
Jeffrey, I'd love to know. I think that goes back to the point we were making earlier, that in order to bridge that huge gap, as you point out, we're going to need both entitlement reform and tax increases. We just need to have a realistic bipartisan discussion about that in this country. And I think, you know, this goes to this deeper issue of structural change in the economy. I think we really have, for a variety of reasons over the last few decades, globalization, technology-based job destruction, the rise of the emerging markets, and the way in which all these vectors are intersecting, that has increased inequality, and it has shifted the way that wealth is distributed in this country. So you have a lot of people at the very top taking home the majority of the pie. Labor's share of our overall economic pie in this country is the lowest it's been in decades. The average American man without a college degree has not gotten a raise in real terms since 1968. So these are major shifts, and I think our tax code needs to start reflecting some of those shifts.
Ross, we've spent almost the whole hour talking without mentioning the name President Obama. What role did he play in all of this?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, he's been given a lot of credit for being so steadfast, in protecting the Affordable Care Act and not wanting anybody to tinker with it and so on. But I've got to tell you that I think a lot of the stiffening of the president's spine had to do with Harry Reid. That I think Reid was totally disgusted by what was known as the fiscal cliff compromise, basically the New Year's compromise of 2012-2013. He told me that when this is the one that was negotiated between Vice President Biden and Mitch McConnell, and he said when he when it came to him, and he was reading it, he was standing in his office, he had a fire in the fireplace. He said, I balled it up and threw it in the fire.
Wow.
Because he felt that the Democrats gave away too much. And I think there was a lot of consultation between Senator Reid's people and people at the White House. And I think Reid's message to the White House was stand fast in the ranks. And I think basically the president picked up on Harry Reid's precept.
And that's Ross Baker joining us along with Rana Farooqar. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Rana, let me shift gears here because looks like Janet Yellen will be the new Federal Reserve chairwoman, the first woman to head up the Fed.
Yes.
You've written about how the Fed has had to step in because Congress has been unable to make decisions about the economy, about finances. Do you see them continuing? Or do you see the Fed and do you see Yellen continuing what Bernanke has been doing?
I absolutely do. Yellen was one of the right-hand women. She was the right-hand woman of Ben Bernanke, and she was one of the chief architects of the program of quantitative easing, which is that asset-buying program that the Fed has been conducting for the last several years now. The Fed is spending about $85 billion a month buying up bonds, buying up mortgage-backed securities in order to try and bolster the stock market and bolster the value of people's homes and essentially kind of try and offset these headwinds from Washington and make people feel a little wealthier and more likely to spend. The big question is, how much more juice is there to throw at the economy? You know, I mean, a lot of people feel, and I'm among them, that quantitative easing is largely tapped out. It's done a lot to bolster the stock market, and you can see that every time a new program of quantitative easing is announced, you get a little stock market kick-up. But those kick-ups tend to be now more shallow and shorter than they were 2 or 3 years ago. And I think that reflects the fact that really there's not a lot of firepower left. We really need to start seeing some more organic, deeper shifts in our economy because I don't think monetary policy can really solve all these problems. That's why you need a functional Congress.
And Ross, about a minute before we have to say goodbye, we got an email from Michael. He says a House rule was changed to prevent any individual House member from bringing a bill for a vote. Make this rule change impossible. Better yet, make it illegal. Any chances that that might happen?
No.
In a word, no.
In a word, no. Yeah, I just don't see that. I don't really understand the purpose of it either.
Meaning?
I don't understand what the objective would be in changing in implementing such a change.
So, are we going to be doing this show in a couple of months, Ross Baker? Are we going to have you two back?
Well, I think so. I think the quixotic quest continues.
I'm going to mark my calendar for February 6th.
We will do the same. But my thanks to both of you, allowing us to kind of toggle back and forth between politics and finance. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Always a pleasure, Ross Baker. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Marty.
And Rana Farooqar, always a pleasure as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Rana Farooqar, Times Assistant Managing Editor in charge of economics and business, and Ross Baker, political science professor at Rutgers University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. And do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.